From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. What's harder than watching your kids wake up to the realities of racism?
He opened up to mom. I remember she cried and told me that he didn't want to go to school because he was being bullied and called names.
A Celine man is at the center of a national conversation about tolerance and what kids of color deal with in majority white schools. Today, he tells his story uninterrupted. And an African-American mother of school-age kids weighs impossible choices and trying to do right by her son.
It was a really difficult time to have to explain to a then 12-year-old that there were adults in his life, teachers, administrators, principals, that really didn't see him.
Also on the program, what's on tap in the governor's budget? Maybe a boost for school funding? All that's coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, a Celine conversation goes national about parenting and what we have to say to kids about racism.
What we must try to do is be better parents and teach our children that we need to stand up for what is right.
We talk later this hour with Adrian Iraola and with a mother from Lansing about her family's experiences. But first, we have some more information for you about Governor Gretchen Whitmer's proposed state budget, a $61.9 billion plan. We have a lot to discuss here, but possibly most notable is that Whitmer says she would like to make what would be the biggest increase for Michigan classroom operations in 20 years, boosting overall K-12 spending by 3.9%. She is also proposing big increases for special education and at-risk students and more. With us today to look it over is Zach Gorchow, the publisher of Gongwer News Service. Zach, welcome back.
Great to be here.
So give us the lay of the land. Does this budget raise any eyebrows?
Well, this is a much different budget in scope than Governor Whitmer's first budget from a year ago. The first budget a year ago was really a moonshot type attempt with the 45-cent per gallon fuel tax increase, which really was bound up into the entire structure of the entire budget. There is essentially no new taxes, no new revenue in this year's budget proposal, which means it's so far, and it's early hours yet since it was unveiled, but it's so far not terribly controversial. The kind of acrimony and controversy that greeted last year's announcement.
And the 45-cent gas tax proposal that came with it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Is not there this time. There's a lot more sort of feel-good proposals in that. There are things that it's kind of difficult to oppose. I mean, you've got new funding to extend eligibility for new mothers to stay on Medicaid for a year, whereas right now they only get 2 months. You have a substantial expansion of the state's preschool program for low-income children. And there's a number of these kinds of things. It's why so far we haven't really seen much in the way of criticism.
Yeah, it's not surprising to find that she's spelling out some of the promises that she mentioned in her State of the State address a couple of days ago. Last year's standoff over the state budget left several projects caught in this dispute between the governor and the legislature. The Pure Michigan marketing campaign comes to mind. Are you seeing some consideration in this budget for things that the Republican majority says are their priorities?
So it's good that you mentioned Pure Michigan. So the governor did propose roughly $15 million for the Pure Michigan program, but I believe that is maybe half or even slightly less than half of what the funding had been prior to the current fiscal year. And you've already seen now the tourism, hospitality, restaurant industry is out saying that's not good enough. You know, let's get back to what we were doing. It was working, but the governor told reporters this afternoon she would like to see the tourism industry itself step up and fill some of that gap as opposed to Michigan taxpayers. The governor did put in funding for a program called Going Pro, which reimburses businesses for the cost of training their employees to get a certificate enhancing their skills, but not at the funding level it was at in the past. So it seems like she's aware that these are programs the Republicans are probably going to want, but she's not at this point willing to bring back all the funding.
We know that the governor intends to try to enact a large bond project to try to get some traction and get some projects started in terms of road repairs. Is there anything noticeable within the transportation budget around road maintenance?
Well, it's a little confusing because the proceeds from the bond sales, which have not happened yet, but once they do happen, go directly to the Department of Transportation, and it can begin pumping those into roads. They don't actually need to go through the appropriations process with the legislature having to vote to spend that money. So, you know, the MDOT budget at this point doesn't really look dramatically different as far as what the legislature sees, but that's because what's happening essentially is the state is promising future fuel tax revenues, future vehicle registration fee revenues to repay those bonds. So it's really wholly contained within MDOT.
I noticed the budget requests $64 million to help the state respond to environmental contamination that may be aimed at folks who've been looking at the green ooze spill and some other big threats that have been high on the radar recently. Does that represent a much of a capacity increase for what the state has been doing so far?
Well, it's certainly a pretty sizable increase, but there's also no question that some of these cleanups can be extremely expensive, and sometimes, you know, it's hard to know just how much it's going to take, you know, the cleanup of PFAS contamination and Northern Kent County or up by the Wurtsmith Air Force Base, although that latter one's more on the federal government to deal with. You mentioned the green ooze. There's the issue down at the Michelin Uniroyal property down in Detroit. You know, I have to think this is probably a proverbial drop in the bucket, but it's certainly a pretty substantial increase from what's being done now.
Zach Gorchow is the publisher of Gongwer News Service. Zach, thank you for checking in today.
Well, thanks for having me.
For a little bit more detail on those education spending increases, we turn now to Brian Gutman with Education Trust Midwest. Brian, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So there was a recent report that Education Trust Midwest published calling for more spending. Folks who've been listening to the show probably heard us talking about it. Let's assume that Governor Whitmer and the legislature are able to agree on the budget priorities. Is what she's outlined going to be enough to address the problems that you were concerned about?
What the governor has proposed today will begin to move Michigan in the right direction, but the reality is that it's taken decades for us to get to the place we are. It's taken decades to build in gross inequities, and it's going to take many, many budget cycles to really work our way out and provide every student with the resources that they need to learn.
That sounds like a good start, but not quite.
that's a good summary. There's a lot to like in this budget, but looking at this, it's quite clear that it makes meaningful progress and doesn't go as far as we have called for to really make sure that every single student has the full amount of resources that they need in order to take full advantage of the educational opportunities that they deserve.
Governor Whitmer says she wants a weighted foundation allowance formula put in place. Mm-hmm. Can you break that down into plainer speech for us?
Sure. Well, what that really looks at is that we've got the equal side of the equation, that every child has real value that they bring, that we should be starting out by funding every child, no matter where they go to school, at the same high enough level to provide them with meaningful opportunities. But it also then recognizes, and this is the weighted part, that kids walk in the door with different needs. a student who comes in the door from a low-income family, often we hear about the vocabulary gap, their exposure to different educational opportunities at home and in the community are going to be different, and their challenges are going to be greater. A student with special needs, it just takes more resources to meet those learning needs. A student who's also learning English for the first time at school has a real additional challenge put on to learning math and science and social studies and all of the other subjects that we learn about. They also have to learn a very difficult language. And so it recognizes that each student comes with different needs, and the goal is to base funding off what the needs of the student truly are.
If we look at this increase on a per pupil basis, it would raise what each school spends on each student by roughly $150 to $225 each year. What might that allow schools to do?
Well, that amount is probably a little bit more than the cost of inflation. It's going to allow them largely to keep up. It also reduces the gap between school districts that are funded at the highest levels and school districts that are funded at the lowest levels by about $75. Eventually, the goal is for that to get to zero. Every student going to school has the same high baseline amount. But again, that's really where funding starts for districts. It's their base, but not all of what they get.
Brian, is this increase compatible with Michigan's need to settle the questions that have been hotly debated in Lansing about road funding? Can we prioritize both?
You know, I think that's the question of the hour. The governor and Zach before me really spoke to this. This is a fundamentally different budget than what the governor proposed last year. We don't see significant revenue increases. And so one of the challenges will continue to be, how do we get enough resources in the door to make up all of the inequities that we see in our system? This budget is substantial. It's nearly $16 billion for K-12 early education and some for higher education. But we really still need significantly more revenue to make sure that all of our educational needs are met.
Brian, we want to thank you very much for taking time with us. I imagine we'll be checking back in with you during the legislative session.
I hope so.
Brian Gutman with Education Midwest. Coming up in just a minute, we focus in on the city of Saline, where a public meeting on how race is handled in public schools blew up. That's just ahead on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. People all over the United States have been watching a short clip this week of a public meeting in Saline, in which local businessman Adrian Iraola, an American citizen who was born in Mexico, was making a comment about something that happened in his family more than a decade ago. He was consoling his then-young son after racist bullying at school. Let's listen to the clip. This audio was captured by MLive.
I went to his bedroom to say goodnight, and he was crying because of the abuse that he was enduring in this school system.
Then why did you stay in Mexico?
You need to leave!
If you can't hear the clip, another parent, a white parent, interrupted Iraola to ask, why don't you go back to Mexico? The shock in that room and all around Michigan was immediate and real, leading to a peace rally in support of immigrants that drew hundreds of people in Saline on Wednesday night. But Saline is still finding its way through conversations among schools, teachers, and families about the disparity in how kids of color are treated. At the pinnacle of this problem is the question of how a parent can support a child who's experiencing racism. We sat down with Adrian Iraola, who's a retired architectural engineer and the owner of three restaurants near Saline. We also invited someone who's parenting school-age kids right now. Tashmika Toruk is an advocate in Lansing. She works in the nonprofit world, she's African-American, and she has three sons. We'll hear from Adrian first. Adrian, first of all, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April.
Will you tell me about your family?
We are the typical American family, I'd like to say. My wife was born and raised in Ann Arbor. Her parents were of German descent. Her dad, rest in peace, lovely man, he did not speak English until he was sent to school. He spoke German. I came here in 1980 to finish some studying, and then I found a job, met my lovely wife. We have been married for about 30 years. I have a son, Andrew, who was part of the narrative. My middle daughter is a graduate from the Law School of Nebraska.
Your kids are adults now.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. So during the time when you were raising kids in Michigan, would you say that they had what kind of school experience they had, whether they felt welcome?
In the early days, everything was fairly normal. But as they started grade school, things started to change a bit. They love reading, studying. I made it a habit, and their mother as well, to read them and teach them the love of books, and to have them learn the value of a good education. Everything was okay, and then things started to change.
How so?
Well, we noticed that there were days when they were reluctant to go to school, and we just took it as normal. I remember days when I said I had tummy ache, and my mom would say, "Hey, do your legs hurt?" And then I said, "No." And says, "Well, then you can walk and go to school." So I don't know that there's a child that doesn't want to stay home. But one day I found out that there were other reasons.
You shared at the public meeting that you found your son in tears one night at least.
Yes.
Over, you know, how he felt about how he was being treated.
Yes.
What kind of experiences was he having?
Well, he did not really want to speak with me about it, but he opened up to mom, and I remember she cried and told me that he didn't want to go to school because he was being bullied and called names.
As a parent, what did you and your wife say to him about these things at that time?
Well, we tried to tell him that this had nothing to do with him. It was others who had ignorant ideas that nobody has the right to insult or bully anyone. And nobody's perfect, so we are going to encounter those issues and events, and we need to learn to disregard them and cope with them and focus on our inner strength.
Do you think he heard that the first time you said such a thing to him?
Not at first, but through repetition and example, they have overcome most of that. I had spoken with them at length recently, and we have shared tears together as early as last night. This is something that we would like to change, and they have overcome a lot of that, but the scars remain.
Tashmika, I'd like to bring you into this conversation. You have three sons.
Yes.
They were going to Catholic schools for most of their school years, I want to say. Can you tell us about the incident that happened in 2017 with one of your sons and how this came to a head for you?
So there were four football players who are now known as the LCHS Four, who were kneeling at a football game and during the anthem in protest of police brutality following Colin Kaepernick's example. And the school threatened them with punishment. And so I took my family. I have three sons. I have currently he's 16 years old, who was at the high school at the time. I have a 14-year-old who was in the middle school, and my littlest one was in the elementary. He is now 11.
Did your son share with you his feelings about what he wanted to do and why he wanted to do it before this became a public concern?
No. No, he did not, actually. What's really interesting to me is I took my children to support these other children and really didn't think too much about it. We talk about racism as a family. We talk about a lot of social issues as a family. I'm a very proactive parent in terms of teaching my children about the world around them and wanting them to understand that our way is not the only way and that there's lots of people living in this world with us. And so I didn't really think a lot about it. And it actually started when my mother came to visit. My mother and my aunt came to visit. And I have a lot of military members in my family. They were just talking about how their legacy as a part being a part of the military for them meant that people were free to protest. And they were just talking about Colin Kaepernick and kind of the anger that other people were feeling. And my son walked in and he said, "Mom, there are some kids kneeling at school during the Pledge of Allegiance." And I said, "That's interesting. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?" And he just said, "You know, just it's to protest police brutality." And I was like, "Okay." And slowly, eventually, he said, "Actually, Mom, I've been kneeling." And
what was your immediate thought that he had been doing it and that that was how he told you about it?
You know, honestly, it didn't surprise me all that much, but I didn't know what to expect. I was hopeful. The school that he was in is probably one of the most diverse Catholic schools in the city. And so I was really hopeful. There's a lot of immigrants, refugees, people of color in that school. I didn't have a grasp of what was actually coming our way. But I also didn't want to impose anything on him, you know, so I really tried to keep my reaction very measured. And I just said, you know, I asked him why he was doing it, and he was very clear about what he was doing it for. And it was, you know, tied to police brutality and racism. And I said, as long as you can speak clearly about why you're doing it, then I don't have a problem with it. Just let me know if you need any support. And that was all we talked about. And then he eventually did need a whole lot of support because the school did not respond in the way that I expected.
Tell us about the reaction.
Well, initially, I was confronted by the administration that said, "We really need Isaac to stand during the Pledge of Allegiance." And I said, "That's not going to work for my family." And they said, "Well, we pray, you know, we stand for the pledge and we kneel to pray." And I was like, "That's interesting, but that's not necessary. I feel like if my child doesn't want to stand for the pledge, there's no reason that we should force him." Then they diverted it to the school priest, that he was in charge of it, and he had made this kind of mandate that that's what was going to happen. And I just refused to compel my child to do that. Eventually, it turned into me finding out from other parents that he was being pulled aside and being told he was being disobedient. Eventually, they decided to have a policy that included all the way up to potential expulsion if he continued. And there were other children who were doing it, too. But he was the only one who ultimately got suspended for a day before they decided to no longer implement the policy. So, it was really hard. It was a really tough time for him.
When you were in the middle of that situation, what did you say to him about the fact that the school was insisting that he not express himself in this way and that he comply?
We spent a lot of time talking about our family's ancestry as enslaved people and how the control of black and brown bodies is something that white supremacy was created for. And so we just reflected on that. And I really just said, you know, if you still want, like, if you choose tomorrow that this is not the thing that you want to do anymore, then that is your choice. And I support you no matter what. And if you choose to continue, I support you no matter what. But we spent a lot of time reading about history and really looking at who his people are and what it means to choose a path, and also that there are always consequences when you decide to stand up and say something is wrong. Even if you're doing the right thing, chances are this is not going to be a peaceful path, that there are going to be people who will harm you along the way. And so it was a really difficult time to have to explain to a then 12-year-old that there were adults in his life, teachers, administrators, principals, all the way up to the bishop that really didn't see him and wanted to make him invisible. So it was really hard.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Tashmika Torak, who is a parent from Lansing, and Adrian Iraola of Celine. They're both parents, and they've both dealt with helping their kids deal with racism over the years. I want to ask both of you, these situations, you know, as we talk to kids who are in a place in their life when perhaps all they want is, you know, acceptance with their friends and to feel a part of the things that they feel a part of in their schools and in their communities, you know, this is a different conversation than we might have with an adult in a situation where they're facing discrimination or bias. I wanted to ask both of you how it challenged you as a parent having to talk about these issues with them. I imagine these conversations were not easy. Adrian, how would you say you were challenged by talking to your kids about this?
Well, it's an additional burden because there are numerous other issues that they deal with on a daily basis, as we all know. You know, there's the peer pressure, acceptance, the clothes, the social circles, lunch tables, homework, sports. And if you add to that an uncomfortable, unwelcoming environment, the easy solution is to drop out because it's so unpleasant. And our job as parents, it's more difficult. Try to teach them self-reliance. And we need to let them know that there are going to be consequences to standing up for themselves. And all along, our children have been able to put this behind and ignore it. But what we must try to do is be better parents and teach our children that we need to stand up for what is right. And I applaud Tashmika's children for sharing and expressing a viewpoint that may not be welcomed by others. But if we remain silent, things will perpetuate. And it's up to our children to receive this kind of knowledge so that they can share it and so that they are better adults.
Tashmika, it's not exactly new for parents of color to have to talk to their kids about how to move through the world safely. But how would you say situations like what your sons went through has challenged you as a parent?
I think it honestly challenged my naivety. You know, I think that there was a time when I was lulled into thinking that, you know, maybe their experience would be a little bit better. I actually grew up in a community that was, it was very diverse. I grew up in El Paso, Texas, which is right on the border of Mexico, and it's a military base. So we were consistently surrounded by culture, all kinds of culture. And moving here was a bit of a shock, but raising my children here was even more difficult because I wasn't prepared for raising my children in a place that was so much of a majority of white people who did not know themselves. And when I say that, I feel like I'm saying that they don't, there is a lack of awareness in terms of their racism. And so when people of color confront them with it, it's a problem. They don't know how to respond. And also when our children start to realize who they are in terms of their culture and their ancestry, and they show any sense of solidarity or pride about that history, it makes white people reflect on their history, and that is very dangerous to our children.
Because they feel uncomfortable and defensive.
And attack. They attack our children. They attack their ability to their own realization of who they are, and it diminishes them. And it forces them to code switch, to switch between who they are in two different spaces. And that is sorrowful. We don't want our children to grow up being half a person. We want them to feel pride in their history and in their culture and be able to navigate this world without the attacks of other white children or white parents. Or, you know, the thing about watching that parent ask that question of why wouldn't you go back to Mexico, for me, when I'm watching that, I'm thinking, these are not just other. First of all, I think a lot of white people think that racists are like somewhere else, like they're in a backwoods somewhere in the South. There are racist parents. There are racist teachers. There are racist administrators. There are racist, like, this is something that is pervasive in our culture. There is a certainty that racists are everywhere. The only thing is uncertain about that is how aware is that white person of their inherent bias and privilege. And so as parents, it becomes really important to be able to have a rich dialogue with your children and to show up for them when people are attacking them and not minimize the harm that is happening, and talking to them and supporting them and naming it. You know, it being a parent and going through this, I feel like my job was made much more difficult because of the way that the administration responded. Because now I'm having to hold this kind of protective space around my child, my baby, from people who think that they're really good people, but they are really invalidating my child and causing him harm that is going to last a long time. And on top of that, refusing to be accountable or even acknowledge that that harm existed in the first place.
We're talking today with Adrian Iraola and Tashmika Torok. They're both parents who've grappled with teaching their kids how to handle racism. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Last night in Saline, hundreds of people came out to march in a show of solidarity for immigrants. A recent public meeting intended to help after students posted racist comments on social media devolved with a racist comment in person directed at my guest, Adrian Iraola. We're also talking with Tashmika Torok, a Lansing parent whose sons were not permitted to take the knee at their Catholic school back in 2017. Let's get back to our conversation about how parents talk to their kids about dealing with racism. Adrian, can you tell us a little bit about how people have reacted to what happened to you in the time since that video went viral?
There's been a number of reactions, and a lot of people have come to me and thanked me for voicing and being able to show our community and the nation now how this racism is still so current and present. And several people have come to me and start thanking me, and then they start narrating stories, and they just burst out crying. And this has touched a nerve in the nation. That's why it's so prevalent right now in the news organizations and periodicals, et cetera. It's very painful to see parents narrating things that have happened to the children and things that have happened to them personally, and to have somebody hug you and cry and sob because their children are dealing with this right now. And I'm at a loss of words to try to comfort people because I have been there myself. But there's been such unity, and at the same time, we are receiving some ugly comments. And I really don't want to say it, but we are being threatened because we stood up.
Your business.
Yeah, it's our business. There's been some sites that have said some really, really ugly things, said that I'm here illegally. I'm a U.S. citizen. All my children were born here. And I don't want to lend any credence to these threats, et cetera, that are being posted. But in the back of my mind, I am afraid. But I'm not going to let that fear quiet my voice. My family and I had a conversation before we attended the school. We attended the school in solidarity to support these young athletes that had been harassed.
Your kids have been out of school for years.
Yes, they have. They have. And
you were just coming as a member of the community.
As a member of the community, we're very involved in the school system. I was a board member of the Soccer Area Association, and we coached. We shared the love of soccer, and that's what immigrants do. They contribute to the wealth and the richness of this beautiful nation. And the vast majority of our experiences were gratifying and wonderful. But there are issues and there are stigmas that we can alleviate and if not completely eradicate, but at least there is awareness. So the vast majority of people surrounding us are wonderful. I am hearing from people that I haven't talked to in 20 years. They're reaching out and congratulating me for saying this. Even people that I, quote-unquote, did not get along with are reaching out and saying, hey,
you know. Supportive things.
Yes, exactly. But the fear of the retribution is there. I have to say that a lot of people have asked me to voice their anger and frustration from not being able to respond to these attacks, and they say, you know, people need to know that there is something wrong, and that it needs to be fixed. And one of the reasons why my wife and I attended this meeting was because we approached the administration and we expressed the problem that was going on and the things that were being said and the discomfort that not just my children but other families were enduring. And something minor was done, but obviously the problems persist. And I think that now they're going to have to take a deep breath and have a strategic plan to educate people and to make things better for our children.
Tashmika, you ended up switching your boys to a different school. Did people, were they aware of what had happened? And did you experience people coming forward to say things to you about that after the fact?
There was a wide breadth of responses. And so individually, there were people who definitely challenged me and definitely told me that my child should just follow the rules and what was the big deal and why were we making such a big deal out of it, who I feel don't have a really complex understanding of history or of, you know, what it feels like to be a person of color in this country. So I really felt like a lot of those questions were very ridiculous. And so I tended to turn away and just focus on my child and focus on what I knew to be true about what my child deserved and how he deserved to be treated, and really focused all my energy on pushing for those things and really sharing. I spent so much time sharing information with the school, with the administration about the impacts of racism on children and the historical information that I felt they needed to make a better decision. And was pretty much, I won't say pretty much, and was completely ignored. And so, yes, ultimately, we did decide to move our kids into the Lansing School District.
And how are they doing?
It was a very difficult transition. My children really lost their community. But, you know, there was a moment after there was some transitions in leadership, some good, some bad within the Catholic Church and the diocese. And my son came to me and he was like, Mom, I think I'm ready. Like, can we go back? And
oh,
I
wow.
will never forget it. Yeah, it was really hard.
What did you say? What did you say to him?
I said, my love, I, as your mother, I watched the adults who essentially helped me raise you refuse to protect you. And I told him, I said, I can't put you back in that situation again. I understand what has changed, but what hasn't changed are the people who stayed silent. And I don't trust them with you. And that was really hard. It's really hard to tell a child that there are adults in their life that will not risk enough to protect them. And so, yeah, that was not a good time. And so we decided, you know, that we wouldn't go back. But I will never forget having to tell my son that truth. And it was hard. So also there's the bit that it's very hard to take any legal action in a religious school. So I really felt like, as much as I am not someone who I have never sued a person in my life, I wouldn't even know where to start. But I know that if their civil rights are violated in a public school, we at least have the support of the federal government, which, you know, take that for what it is. You never know. You're still a person of color in the world. But I just also wanted to be wise about where we relocated to. And I also didn't want my child in a spiritual place that was not living up to the teachings that they were kind of the teachings of the church that they are. And I didn't want that kind of hypocrisy in my children's lives.
Yeah.
So it was a tough decision, but there were many, many reasons why we left.
How are your boys doing these days?
They're doing well. They're doing well. They're amazing kids. The transition was really hard, but I feel like for all the things that we struggled with and that loss of community, they are getting closer to solid ground every day. The thing about being a family and being committed to one another is that, you know, we take on each other's sacrifices. And so we are pushing forward, and this will be a formative moment for them. I believe that, for better or for worse. But I actually am very hopeful and very excited about who my three sons will be someday.
Adrian, I wonder, it's probably not so easy to just go back to one's normal life after being at the center of a situation like you experienced in the past couple of weeks. But are you going to just try to get things back to normal? What's next?
I'm just trying to get back, as you mentioned, but our lives will never be the same. We have been put in a position that we can now be the voice of a lot of oppression. And one seldom gets an opportunity to do things over. And as Mika was mentioning, the changes in school for her children. And my wife and I were talking about what could we have done differently. And our children, and mind you, I use the word children because they are my...
They're adult children now.
My adult children. They, in unison, told us that they wish we would have transferred schools to a more diverse system. And that was very painful, and I feel you, Tashmik. I can feel your pain, and we as parents, everybody tries to provide their children with the best. You find a school district that you think will give them an excellent education and facilities and environment. Our educators need to be more aware of what they are not doing. If we don't participate and if we don't raise our voices and say, hey, that is wrong, you cannot say that, then we are being participants in these acts, and the reaction that a lot of these administrations have, oh, let's form a committee, an inclusion committee, let's do a march. Jointly and as groups of people, we can do a lot. But first and foremost, we need to look within and ask ourselves in the solitude of our own environment and say, am I really accepting of others? Am I really ready to be a good person and a kind human being? And if I am not, I am like a cancerous cell that can infect others. And I don't have a solution for this problem. I just want to reach out to those people that may be listening to me and then say, hey, why don't you go back? Because there are people out there that may think that way. But you have to look at, why are you here? Because somebody decided to look a better future, not just for him or herself, but for their children, and to provide them with a better life. And human beings are nomads. We move, we go seeking the better opportunities. Realize that you are here for a reason, that people go places seeking opportunity and betterment. I hope that something good comes out of all of this.
Adrian Iraola lives in Saline. He's the owner of three businesses, two in Ann Arbor and one in Dexter. We've also been talking with Tashmika Torok. She's a mother of three in Lansing. And as it says in her professional bio, she incites riots of generosity and advocates for the healing of children and families every day. I want to thank both of you so much for coming and doing this work in addition to all the work that you're already doing.
Thank you, April.
Thank you so much, April.
Michigan radio reporter Dustin Dwyer brought the oddest coincidence to our attention last night. Even though all of Michigan's Republican representatives sided with President Donald Trump in votes around impeachment, both of the GOP lawmakers who broke ranks voting to impeach and remove President Donald Trump are natives of Michigan. West Michigan Congressman Justin Amash is an independent these days, but he generally votes with his former Republican Party colleagues. Here he is talking about impeachment on the House floor.
I come to this floor not as a Democrat, not as a Republican, but as an American who cares deeply about the Constitution, the rule of law, and the rights of the people.
And Senator Mitt Romney of Utah had this to say yesterday.
I take an oath before God as enormously consequential. I knew from the outset that being tasked with judging the president, the leader of my own party, would be the most difficult decision I have ever faced. I was not wrong.
Remember that Mitt Romney was born and raised in Michigan, where his father, George Romney, was governor. While Mitt Romney is on the receiving end of some harsh criticism from Republicans and conservative pundits today, he might look to his father, who wasn't always popular with his party either. George Romney, asked to slow desegregation efforts as the head of Nixon's Department of Housing and Urban Development around 1969 and 1970, reportedly said, quoting here, "What's really at issue is responsibility, moral responsibility." He said those words of then-President Richard Nixon. I don't know what the president believes in. Maybe he doesn't believe in anything. That's it for today's show. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening.